absurdity that my friends in Gaza are describing. I mean, when we tell people to evacuate, but go where? It's very hard to find shelter in these conditions. People are sleeping in the streets. Winter is coming. It's starting to rain in Beirut. We're starting to talk about the possibility of epidemics spreading. So this is really a huge, catastrophe. And it's not a humanitarian one. It is a political catastrophe, and it's a social catastrophe.
And Professor Majid,
this would not have happened if it wasn't for the...
Go ahead. This wouldn't have happened if it weren't for...
If it wasn't for the backing and the arming of Israel.
And your response, we have just a minute, to Israel saying they're just destroying, trying to destroy Hezbollah. They're telling everyone else to leave, to protect them.
Yeah, we've heard the same thing in Gaza. They're just trying to destroy Hamas. I mean, two things. First, it's important to understand who Hezbollah is. Hezbollah, of course, is a political and military organization, but Hezbollah is also has a social base, and these are not people that are involved in military action.
Rima, we have just
15
seconds.
The other thing that I want to highlight is that the war of Israel on Lebanon has not started with the creation of Hezbollah in 82. Israel has invaded Lebanon way before 82. Hezbollah was created as a result of the Beirut invasion in 82. So the aim, I think, is not just Hezbollah.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
Listen to Armando Puentes every Sunday from 1:30 p.m. to 3:30 p.m., playing the best in Tejano mixing with some traditional conjunto, as well as mariachi music and public affairs pertaining to the Latino community. That's Armando Puentes, only on KBOO Portland.
Support for this program comes from KBOO members and McMenamin's Crystal Ballroom, presenting Fiesta Night, an evening of reggaeton and Latin music in Lola's Room, Friday, September 20th at 9 p.m. Tickets and information for this 21 and over event at Crystal Ballroom PDX.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Multnomah County will open its Drug Deflection Center next week. Portland police request more than $2 million extra dollars in potential overtime for possible election protests, and a revised Northwest Forest Plan could be a boon for the region's salmon populations. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 7th, 2024. I'm Althea Billings. Multnomah County will open its Drug Deflection Center on Monday, October 14th, a week from today. That's a month and a half after drugs were recriminalized in the state. Multnomah County has lagged behind in its preparation compared to other nearby counties like Washington County. A Baltimore contractor was hired to run the deflection center, but first they had to renovate the building, hire, and train staff. The center is called the Coordinated Care Pathway Center. It's located in the Buckman neighborhood at 980 Southeast Pine Street. It will be a drop-off program for people who are arrested for drug possession. At the center, they can be screened and guided towards services and treatment. Only people who are stopped by police while they're sober and possessing only a small amount of drugs are eligible. If they've been stopped for possession in the past 30 days and refused deflection services, they're not eligible for the program, which is intended to keep people out of jail for a relatively minor offense. The Pathway Center will offer sobering beds eventually, but officials say that won't be available until April of next year. Starting Monday, it will be open 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. on weekdays, and 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. on weekends. Officials say those hours were decided on based on the first few weeks of drug recriminalization in Oregon. That was when there was more of a demand for deflection services. The deflection program and connection to treatment services is only available to people who are stopped by police for possession. In 2022, a study by OHSU and PSU found that over 130,000 people in Multnomah County had substance use disorder, and 99% of them had a treatment need that wasn't being met. Multnomah County reported that 71 people were put into deflection services in the month since drugs were recriminalized. Since the Pathways Center doesn't open until next week, they were served by mobile deflection teams. Last month, the county board voted unanimously to find a space for a new sobering center that could serve 30 to 50 people at a time. They say they'll request proposals this month and hope to pick a contractor for the sobering center early next year. Portland police want $2.3 million from the city discretionary fund to cover potential overtime costs if there are protests after Election Day. Portland City Council will consider this budget bump at Wednesday's council meeting. Last week, Police Chief Bob Day announced officers will have to cancel planned days off and work overtime starting on November 5th. They say $2 million of those dollars would be for election-related protests and the rest would be for university policing. In May, police cleared a pro-Palestinian protest from the PSU library. Police are also asking for an additional $1.2 million in unspecified overtime costs on top of the $2.3 million. City budget officials wrote in the memo that police didn't tell them what activities they would have to drop or change if they don't get the money, but the memo says response times could get longer for people calling 911. The largest healthcare strike in the country's history took place a year ago. In Oregon hospitals, that's meant an increase in wages for workers and a concentrated look at understaffing. Eric Tegedoff takes a look back at what the strike accomplished.
It's been 1 year since the largest healthcare strike in U.S. history, and union members say they've seen changes since their 2023 victory. More than 85,000 workers at Kaiser Permanente in Oregon and four other states conducted a three-day strike in October 2023 and won a 21% wage increase over 4 years. Kevin Darden is a patient access representative with the Kaiser Permanente Sunnyside Medical Center in Clackamas and was a member of the negotiation team with SEIU Local 49 during the strike. He says there were risks involved in the strike.
This wasn't an easy decision for us. It took a lot of time planning and speaking to not just our peers, but our families regarding what striking would mean to us and how we know it would affect our stance and our income to be able to do that for those 3 days.
Darden says healthcare workers wanted to address the demand from the growing Portland region. SEIU Local 49 says members won the largest wage package in 25 years. Darden says the biggest concern for workers were understaffing and turnover. He says they've teamed up with management to analyze the staffing needs of departments in their hospitals. Darden says more staff benefits patients.
Ultimately, it's leading to more availability to see providers. And overall, it's a huge victory for us because we're able to start getting the manpower that we need to be able to meet the demand of the city and be able to really see our patients in a timely manner.
The Kaiser strike was among many strikes that took place last year and have continued this year, such as with the recent longshoremen strike. Darden says the actions have been empowering to see.
Companies are seeing record profits, and we're the backbones of the company, right? We're the ones that show up every day on time. We do the work. We see the patients or we see the customers, and we deserve to be rewarded for the hard work and for the profits that these companies are earning.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Portland City Council will consider a resolution on the future of the Keller Auditorium this week. It's on the City Council agenda for Thursday, October 10th at 2 p.m. Keller Auditorium is an important space in the arts world in Portland. When Broadway shows come to town, they come to the Keller. But the structure is in danger of collapse in a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake, so there have been plans to retrofit the Keller or replace it entirely. There's been competing plans on what to do. On the docket for Thursday is a sort of both-and plan. Develop two Broadway-capable venues, one where the Keller Auditorium sits today and build another one at Portland State University. This type of approach means Portland could avoid major disruptions to the performance schedule as renovation and building happens. If passed, the resolution on the Keller would analyze the two-pronged approach, both in terms of market feasibility, traffic, and it would also create a project oversight committee. 5 years ago, Oregon launched a statewide housing plan, and now Oregon Housing and Community Services is reporting on their progress. Here's Director Andrea Bell.
First, I think it's important to take a step back and remember how we got here. Leading up to 2019, Oregon Housing and Community Services and leaders across the state came together, united by a bold and common cause, to make everyday life better for the people of Oregon through advancing affordable housing progress. So we got to work. And along the 5 years, we confronted unforeseen challenges and opportunities together. Economic uncertainty, a testing of our commitment to racial justice through reducing racial disparities, global supply chain disruptions, and taking concrete steps to invest in the vibrancy and value of rural Oregon. Together, we are delivering results to strengthen Oregon. Over 28,000 and counting affordable new homes built across the state. Now, while this progress may not make it to the national news, to the people whose lives are better off because of this progress, it matters enormously. Now, our most important steps are in front of us, and the state we love and call home is what connects us, and we are just getting started.
That was Oregon Housing and Community Services Director Andrea Bell speaking about Oregon's statewide housing plan that kicked off in 2019. Over these 5 years, they report they've funded over 5,000 affordable housing units in rural Oregon. They also helped to fund permanent supportive housing and affordable rental housing around the state. The LaModa Cannabis Shop in St. John's in Portland was the scene of a shooting on Thursday night. Police arrived to find two people had been shot and killed. Shattered glass from broken windows and display cases littered the floor. The store had been closing early at 9 p.m. due to a string of robberies. The shootings happened about half an hour after closing. An eyewitness who's lived in the neighborhood for 4 years told KGW, quote, "I heard about 10 loud pops of gunshots going across the street." Another neighbor added, quote, "It's a store with a lot of cash in it. It was around the time it was closing. It's a place that would get robbed eventually." Detectives investigating the case have yet to release names, official cause of death, or details on what happened leading up to the shooting. Portland dispensaries have become a major target for criminals. Many dispensaries have been robbed multiple times, with one owner telling COIN they have had dozens of incidents in the past 3 years. State and federal leaders are working on legislation to give all cash-legal cannabis businesses access to banking and financial services. Currently, all dispensaries must do their transactions in cash. Senator Jeff Merkley says the Safer Banking Act has just passed through a congressional committee with a strong vote. There's hopes it will improve employee safety and limit the financial and physical damages to these businesses. The conflict between Israel and Hamas started a year ago, and Vice President Harris is being pressed on her position. Trump returns to campaign at the place he was shot at, and voter registration deadlines take effect with less than a month until Election Day. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Do we have an important alliance between the American people and the Israeli people? And the answer to that question is yes.
Today marks 1 year of war between Israel and Hamas. Despite continued violence, Vice President Kamala Harris says the United States supports Israel but remains committed to getting a ceasefire. The Hamas-run health ministry said 26 people were just killed in airstrikes on a Gaza mosque and school housing refugees. More than 40,000 Palestinians have died while conflict is now rising in Lebanon. Democratic Senator John Fetterman told Fox News Sunday that former President Donald Trump knows the importance of Pennsylvania.
In 2020, I put out a picture of the Butler rally from Trump. Mm-hmm. And Dallas said it's going to be very close in 2020, and then it was. And now back he was in Butler, and it's the same thing.
Over the weekend, Trump returned to Butler, where 3 months ago he was shot at during a rally. He was joined by tech CEO Elon Musk, who called the former president brave. Former First Lady Melania Trump's clear stance as a supporter of reproductive rights comes as a departure from her husband's changing but generally pro-life positions.
Individual freedom is a fundamental principle that I safeguard. Without a doubt, there is no room for compromise when it comes to this essential right that all women possess from birth.
Several times, her husband has changed his position on a national abortion ban, but he called state abortion bans a beautiful thing to watch. Analysts say Melania may be trying to soften his unpopular positions to appeal to moderate voters. Polling shows most Americans back the idea of Supreme Court term limits, and many want the court expanded to 15 justices. And Joe Hines with Stand Up America says with the current justices aging, people should keep the court's controversial opinions and ethics scandals in mind when picking the next president.
You're not just voting for a president, you're not just voting for Congress, you're also voting for generations of decisions that will impact fundamental rights.
During his first White House press briefing while president, Joe Biden said he's confident next month's election would be free and fair, but said it might not be entirely peaceful.
I don't know whether it will be peaceful. The things that Trump has said and the things that he said last time when he didn't like the outcome of the election were very dangerous.
Trump has refused to clearly say he would respect the results if he loses. Today's the last day to register online to vote in next month's election in Arizona, including for people with disabilities. Ronaldo Fowler with Disability Rights Arizona says they want full access to the electoral process.
Change the culture from the top, from the election administrators down to persons with disabilities, down to family members having high expectations for their loved ones to vote.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, KBOO presents Running on Air. On this episode, we're speaking with District 1 candidates Mike Sands and Joe Allen. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 48. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a daytime high of 69. Today in history, in 1885, Danish physicist Niels Bohr was born. He developed the Bohr model of the atom and made foundational contributions to the understanding of the atomic structure and quantum theory. The quote of the day is from Bohr, who said, quote, "It is wrong to think that the task of physics is to find out how nature is. Physics concerns what we can say about nature." An Indigenous man in Manitoba has been exonerated after serving 50 years in jail. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An Indigenous man convicted of murder 50 years ago has been acquitted. The Manitoba judge called the wrongful conviction a case that involved systemic discrimination. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
Clarence Woodhouse, now 72, always maintained he was innocent in the killing of a restaurant worker in Winnipeg. He was one of four men convicted in 1974 in the fatal beating and stabbing. Woodhouse is the third man exonerated in that death. Canada's justice minister ordered a review of the case as possible miscarriages of justice. The prosecuting attorney told the court that police had coerced and manufactured a statement from one of the accused who had limited English. Clarence Woodhouse spent 12 years in prison before being paroled. His lawyer said that the case against Woodhouse was infested with racism from beginning to end. Crown prosecutors acknowledged that systemic racism had impacted the case and led to a miscarriage of justice. Chief Justice Glenn Joyal apologized to Woodhouse on behalf of the justice system. That was echoed by Matt Weeb, the Attorney General of Manitoba.
As the Attorney General of Manitoba, I offer my heartfelt apologies to Mr. Woodhouse and his family.
A lawyer for the group known as Innocence Canada, Jerome Kennedy, says they are working on other cases involving Indigenous men from Ontario, Alberta, and Saskatchewan.
Statistically, we know that with the disproportionate number of Indigenous people in jail, that there has to be wrongful convictions. Oftentimes, these people don't know who to reach out to or how to reach out.
As for Woodhouse, he says he's looking forward to spending time with his son and grandchildren and probably just relaxing. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The indoor football team Colorado Spartans announced plans to play in Denver for the 2025 season. The team's owner, Tony Thompson, is half Yankton Sioux and half Black. He wants to leave a legacy on and off the gridiron. Colorado Public Radio's Tony Gorman has more.
Thompson's decision to relocate the team from Loveland, Colorado to the Denver Coliseum wasn't motivated by money, but by community outreach. The former South Dakota State football player and business owner wanted to offer affordable advertising opportunities to small business owners. Legacy also drives Thompson, who grew up on a reservation in South Dakota. He flies the Yankton Sioux tribal flag at games to honor his family back home.
My grandma, my ancestors, all that, you know, that's home for me. So I give love back to them because not a lot of people make it out of the res. And so I don't know, I'd not say I'm inspiration, but I hope that they can see that, hey, we could do something.
Thompson is offering affordable family ticket packages for the upcoming season. He says the team also plans to be involved with youth sports once it moves to Denver. For National Native News, I'm Tony Gorman in Denver.
The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma is offering assistance to those impacted by Hurricane Helene near the eastern bound of Cherokee Reservation in North Carolina. Last week, the tribe's emergency management team, along with students and staff from the Cherokee Nation Immersion School, traveled to the region to offer help. They organized donated items and assembled food and care kits for families impacted by the storm. The team delivered 38,000 bottles of water from the Cherokee Nation. Students also helped with community cleanup efforts. The Cherokee Nation says it has a long history of stepping forward in times of need and remains committed to providing assistance. Michigan State University recently introduced a Native American tuition program. It will offer in-state tuition rates to out-of-state Native American students through the new MSU Native American Tuition Advantage Program. According to the university, the program aims to eliminate financial barriers and increase enrollment among Native students. The program will start in the fall of 2025. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Locals in Washington State's lower Yakima Valley have been sounding the alarm about nitrate pollution from large-scale animal feeding operations. Those operations have proved hard to regulate. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Large-scale animal feeding operations can have impacts on the quality of local drinking water. In Washington State's lower Yakima Valley, nitrate pollution has been found in 20% of all wells. Discharge from pits known as lagoons, where animal waste mixes with water, has been linked to serious health risks, like higher rates of cancer. In 2008, when a dairy operation tried to move onto the Yakima Indian Reservation, neighbors like Gene Mendoza raised their concerns.
The people who live next to the dairies there were very unhappy. The dairies at that time were very bad neighbors.
Gene Mendoza later became head of Friends of Deponish Creek, which pushes for more oversight in industrial agriculture. Despite the health risks, large animal feeding operations have proved hard to regulate. Large-scale operators say they are always looking for ways to be more environmentally sensitive while trying to keep up with consumer demand. Mendoza says dairy operations have consolidated in the lower Yakima Valley, and that's made it difficult to push back on them.
It removes decision-making from the ground level and sends it up the corporate ladder and makes it harder for neighbors, makes it harder for Friends of Toppenish Creek.
Amy Van Zon is a senior attorney for the Center for Food Safety and says consolidation into a few big companies has led to a decline in dairy herds, but not milk production. She says the centralization that comes with consolidation means local efforts to protect drinking water have become harder, and the need for federal regulations has become greater.
We're paying the price, and we're going to keep paying the price, and it's the people who are the least well-off in rural areas and especially marginalized communities. Communities of color are the ones paying the biggest price for this.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Struggling salmon and other fish species could benefit from an updated Northwest Forest Plan. The U.S. Forest Service is set to release a draft environmental impact statement for the plan amendment next month. While the recommended updates don't address fish populations specifically, they still could see habitat improvements. Elaine Harvey is Watershed Department Manager for the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. Harvey says update recommendations include support of wildlife migration corridors and protection for old growth forests.
The riparian corridors would assist with the cold water effusia that the forest systems provide, like into the Columbia River or even just to the different streams on the forest lands. Those are key areas also where we have juvenile rearing in the forested areas.
The Northwest Forest Plan was adopted in 1994 for management of forests in Washington, Oregon, and Northern California. New changes to the plan stress addressing climate change and tribal treaty rights. Harvey notes that cold water is critical for salmon, and it's part of the reason fish are struggling in the Northwest.
Each salmon species have their own threshold, and water temperature, you know, is really a key environmental attribute that could limit survival of salmon.
Harvey says once the draft environmental impact statement is released, the public can comment on it.
It's a little critical that everyone takes time to read the document and submit their comments, especially the tribes, because there are 80 plus tribes that are affected by this plan. And when the original plan was created, the tribes were not consulted with.
Our thanks to Claire Carlson at the Daily Yonder for her help reporting this story. Key issues are being debated ahead of the November election, from the economy to immigration. But the future of the Supreme Court has emerged as another focal point following a range of controversial opinions and ethics scandals. Mike Mullen reports from Wisconsin.
With a month to go before the presidential election, voters in swing states such as Wisconsin are likely to hear more messaging about the outcome shaping the future of the nation's highest court. In a recent Ipsos poll, 4 in 5 Americans said nominations to the U.S. Supreme Court will be an important factor when casting their ballot. The court and its conservative majority have come under scrutiny over decisions regarding abortion protections and presidential immunity, as well as ethics issues. Joe Hines of the left-leaning advocacy group Stand Up America says with 4 of the 9 justices soon turning 70, another Trump presidency could push the court even further right.
We are trying to make it clear to voters that when you're voting this year, you're not just voting for a president, you're not just voting for Congress, you're also voting for generations of decisions that will impact you, your family, your children, your grandchildren's fundamental rights.
As for public polling, a majority of Americans back the idea of Supreme Court term limits, but only a small percentage of Republican voters support expanding the court to 15 justices. Most Democrats embrace that possible reform. Some GOP lawmakers have argued certain changes would be unconstitutional. But advocates like Hines contend there's a huge conflict of interest with the court right now.
We'll continue to hear a lot of cases around voting rights, including probably cases around this very election, cases around the president's power. So they'll be hearing a lot of cases that concern the people that are appointing them.
He notes that a handful of justices taking up these issues, especially matters directly involving former President Donald Trump, were appointed during Trump's term in office. In the same Ipsos poll, more Americans think the court decides cases on the basis of political views than the law. This is Mike Mullen for Wisconsin News Connection.
Energy efficiency job training provides incarcerated people with new career opportunities. In Illinois, they're doing just that, with 25 people already hired upon release. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When people are released from prison, they often struggle to find jobs.
And in a country where we claim justice is for all, people serve their time, but they're still battered and bruised because opportunities are slim to none for them.
Scott Allen Davis is with SEAL, a company that provides energy efficiency services. It's partnered with the utility Ameren Illinois to offer training in this industry to people at the Peoria Adult Transition Center in Illinois, which houses people who are still incarcerated but participating in a work release program.
And then when they come out of the transition housing, they have employment that is now paying them enough where they can afford housing and other things to take care of themselves.
In 3 years, about 25 participants have been hired in energy efficiency jobs upon their release. The program also provides mental health, financial literacy, and other counseling. Davis says the opportunity can change people's lives.
And it's not just their life, it's a generational change for everybody that's going to come behind them that have different opportunities now. So it's very exciting.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 7th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Ed Travaglia, the producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Suzanne Potter, Alex Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members, lovely people like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
Making contact.
Making contact.
You're listening to Making Contact. I'm Lucy Kang. Monday marks 1 year since October 7th, 2023. That day, over 1,000 people were killed and more than 200 taken hostage when Hamas-led fighters broke out of the border wall surrounding Gaza. Israel responded with a brutal and disproportionate assault on Gaza that has displaced nearly 2 million people in what many are calling a genocide. One study suggested that as of July, almost 200,000 Palestinians had been killed. And of course, all of this is in the larger historical context of Israel imposing decades of crushing apartheid conditions on Gaza. In the first half of the show, we're going to hear from some of those surviving the conflict. And I just want to warn you that some of this might be hard to listen to, but we thought it was important to bring you the voices of Palestinians in Gaza who have lived through the horrors of this war. So now, we wanted to bring you an update from someone you've heard on our show before, longtime journalist Rami Almagari. He's been reporting on the ground since the start of the genocide.